The following program is being brought to you on the Voice America Variety Channel. For more information about our network and to check out additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericavariety.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the hosts or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.
Consider yourself a home dreamer? One who watches the renovation programs on television? Are you just waiting for the right time to build or renovate your dream home? Welcome to Winning the Dream Home Race with Steve Cliff Architect. Steve has spent 3 decades learning how to win at the dream home game. He has insights into the psychology of space that could strengthen your marriage and soothe your soul. He has an understanding of market forces and the methodologies of construction that could save you thousands of dollars, and he could make you a winner. Now, here's Steve Clip.
Hi, people. Welcome back. Well, today I'm going to talk about the row houses in Washington, D.C. But before you turn off and say, you know, I don't have row houses here, what I'm going to talk about is really applicable to any older in-town neighborhoods, and which are in virtually every city in America. When you think about it, even relatively new cities like Jacksonville, Florida, or Phoenix, Arizona, have 50-year-old neighborhoods that are being revived and gentrified. And these same things are applicable to them. Why Washington? Primarily because I have a daughter who graduated from college, took a job, and moved there about 2 years ago. Elizabeth, my daughter, wants to be a real estate developer. And she has also lived her whole life with home construction projects because we've always are renovating something. So she came to D.C. with a new degree, some financial backing from her parents, and eager to get started on her first house, which is really brave for a 22-year-old single female. And I think if she'd been a little older and wiser, she may have been more hesitant. But before I get into this, really, you know, to understand the market, and you should always understand your market before you buy. She spent 6 months or more going around Washington identifying neighborhoods and target houses. And then she and I spent a lot of time going to the open houses of homes that had been, you know, renovated and were being showed for sale in downtown Washington. And frankly, most of them are pretty bad. A lot of them are being done by flippers, and which means that everything in them is being done as close to bottom dollar as possible. And because the flipper isn't going to live in the house, there's no incentive to fix what is conceptually wrong with the house, to bring the house up to today's way of living. No, you just make all the surfaces nice and shiny bright, and you sell it to somebody else. The problem is that when you do that, I've told you many times that you make your money on the front end when you buy, and it's only confirmed on the back end when you sell. So if you buy a bad house, and especially in a relatively hot market like Washington, then you pay full price for it, if the market cools, that bad house is going to have a hard time selling on the back end and is going to sell at a discount. So it's a buyer beware, but anyway, I found an incredible number of houses that just weren't well done in renovating these row houses. Now, if you've spent any time in Washington, D.C., you have to be familiar with the ubiquitous row houses there. D.C.'s in-town neighborhoods were developed between the 1880s and 1920s. It's 100 to 150 years ago. It's interesting to me that even at that time, the developers had to tear down existing low-density housing in order to put up new higher-density housing. They would take one house on a 60 by 100-foot lot, tear it down, and they put up six row houses, all 16 feet wide. The row house would sit close to the street on the front and, when possible, have an alley in the back. The typical row house is two stories high, and sometimes there's a basement as well. The basement's imported from a resale and intrinsic value point of view because it's usable space. But a surprising number of these basements in Washington, D.C., and almost every one that Elizabeth and I looked at, the basements were under 7 feet tall. And that's important because 7 feet is the minimum height that qualifies as living space by the building code, and the minimum height that qualifies as living space from an appraisal point of view. So in all of these houses, you'd have the two stories and the basement, but the appraiser isn't allowed to consider the basement to be living space because it's less than 7 feet tall. However, you still have it. It's still usable unless you're a basketball player. And I really don't know of any houses, I saw very few, that had a third floor. Perhaps this is a consequence of the way they were constructed. The shell of the row houses are all brick. They're made of brick. The side walls between the units are made of 8-inch thick solid brick, which is great because it creates a 3-hour firewall between the units, meaning that it takes 3 hours for a fire, unabated, to break through that wall. The front and the back walls are also made of solid brick. And which, you know, one of the issues with these row houses is the walls are solid brick, meaning there's no insulation in them. The good thing is that they're in a row, so only the front and the back are exposed to the elements, and the sides are conditioned by the houses beside them. Now, I can see how they could only build these walls so tall. And, you know, and that may be because they were made out of 8-inch thick brick. You could only build it 2 stories tall, or 2 stories above a basement. The other thing about these row houses is that most of them were built for working class people, blue collar workers, and lower level federal workers. So they were modest. They were usually between 1,000 square feet to about 1,500 square feet, not counting the basement. And, you know, I don't know, even if no one else is fascinated by dissecting these homes, I am. It's interesting to me that form follows function. These row houses built for working class people were about as efficient at housing people or families as they could be. And for the people who bought them, they were utopia. These people were living in tenement flats. They often, back in the late 1800s, they shared a kitchen or a bathroom. The idea of having a whole house to themselves, even if it was a tiny whole house, was Utopia. Even if it was only 16 feet wide, sometimes they were 20 feet wide, but I've actually seen them as small as 10 feet wide. Now, admittedly, there are more expensive row houses in Washington, but my daughter and I weren't really looking at the high end. The houses that started off as being middle to upper class houses in neighborhoods that have always been nice. She's just starting out, and the beat up houses in transitional neighborhoods that started out as working class houses, they're still incredibly pricey. They are unbelievably highly priced for, you know, these working class shells of houses. But there is a higher end row house. If you have $1 million, and we're really not talking about them. I've told you form follows function. The row houses almost always have the same very efficient plan. There has to be a window in each room. So the houses are two rooms deep. Windows on the front of the house, windows on the back of the house. And with the straight staircase right inside the door along the side wall. It's funny, the staircases are really narrow. They're usually 30 inches wide instead of the 36 inches that we're required to have today. And almost never when these houses are renovated does that change. Because if you've got a 30-inch wide staircase and it's existing, it doesn't use up that much space, and space is at a real premium. Often when you had, so you had a two-room deep house, but often when you had a 16-foot wide row house, they would add a third back room that was only 12 feet wide. That way, the middle room, which was usually a dining room, always a dining room, had one window to the outside from that middle room. Almost always, there's a porch on the front of the house. So on hot summer days, you can sit out where it's cooler. And always, it seems like always, these are one story tall. There really wasn't a use for a second floor porch on the front of the houses. On the back, there was also a porch. This time it's two stories tall. On the main level, it's a utility porch where they did things like the clothes washing and cleanup. On the upper porch was a great place to sleep on hot summer nights. Interestingly, in these houses, the front porches seem to always have stayed open. People haven't enclosed them because porch sitting is still an important activity and, you know, something we do today. But the back porches have always, almost always are now enclosed. If you think about it, a house that is 32 feet deep, enclosing the 8-foot deep back porch makes a house 40 feet deep and actually gives you 25% more space. So almost always we found that they enclose these back porches. It makes a 1,028 square foot house into a 1,280 square foot house. Interesting to me, because I, you know, because of codes, all of these back porches that were added onto the houses do not have firewalls to separate them from their neighbors. And over the years, they've been enclosed. So now they're interior space without the firewall that the rest of the townhouse has, the row house. And they should be forbidden. But at this point, they're grandfathered in, and it's just accepted in D.C. that you have these connected enclosed porches on the back of the houses. Okay, I'm going to go to break, but when we come back, I'll get off the history lesson and we'll fast forward it 100 years to today.
talk. That's all we do is talk.
Yeah!
If you'd like to talk, call us toll-free right now at 1-866-472-5787. 1-866-472-5787.
That's it.
VoiceAmerica.com.
Think of the world 50 years ago. Now think of this same world and how it'll be 50 years from now. Did you know that if the world's population continues to grow at its current rate, our children and grandchildren will only have 25% of the resources per capita that our parents and grandparents had? We must preserve the foundation of a quality standard of living. That foundation starts with Go Green Radio. Join your host, Jill Buck, for Go Green Radio every Friday at noon Eastern, 9 a.m. Pacific on Voice America.
These days, everyone is looking for information on staying young, healthy, and fit. The Voice America Health and Wellness Network is here to help you on your quest to better health and a better you. We talk about everything from diet, fitness, and aging to substance abuse, personal growth, mental health, and much more. Learn from our experts who cover health and wellness from traditional and holistic perspectives. Tune in to the Voice America Health and Wellness Network. Healthy living starts here.
Each week, Jimmy Gould brings you the stories and the people that you want to hear about. Tune in to A Current Life to hear about the journey to success, how our guests became the people they are today, and the highs and lows they experienced along the way. Each hour will leave you inspired and entertained as Jimmy gets up close and personal with every week's guest and shares ideas you can identify with and apply to your own life. A Current Life with Jimmy Gould airs Fridays at 3 p.m. Eastern Time, noon Pacific Time on the Voice America Variety Channel.
Streaming live, the leader in Internet talk radio, VoiceAmerica.com.
You're tuned into Winning the Dream Home Race with your host, Steve Klipp. We'd love to hear from you about our program. Call in to 1-866-472-5788. Again, that's 1-866-472-5788. Or send an email to clipark@yahoo.com. That's C-L-I-P-P-A-R-C-H at yahoo.com. Now, back to winning the dream home race.
Okay, enough of the history lesson. Let's talk about today. Washington has a lot of low income and poverty. A lot of these downtown neighborhoods have seen generations of poverty. Most of the houses were solidly built to begin with, but decades of neglect and often occupancy by tenants mean that many of the row houses are in terrible shape. Even the ones owner-occupied but neglected are in terrible shape. However, today, many of the well-paid workers for the federal government want to live in town near work. So any address that is within a half mile of a metro station has become ripe for gentrification. 2 years ago, when Elizabeth started looking, a shell of a row house needing total renewal but near a metro station, could sell for just under $300,000. $300,000, a shell of a row house. And that was in a down market with a lot of uncertainty and difficulty in getting financing. Well, that same sorry shell today is closer to $350,000. This is a shell, and $250 a square foot. The federal government has increased their spending. Federal government hiring has increased. And this means that Washington, D.C. was one of the first places to come out of the real estate recession. And now it is hot. The market is hot. And you think about it, a shell of a house is selling for $250 to $300 a square foot. not counting, you know, basements and garages, if you can find one with a garage. That's a real, would be a real plus. In most of the country, that would buy you a complete upscale house. In most of the country, if you were talking about 1,200 square feet for $300,000, that would be a very upscale home or townhouse. Well, before we get into anything else, my daughter may not speak to me again, but let me tell you about two of the stumbles that she had early in her search. I'm incredibly proud of her and what she has done, but doesn't mean there weren't some stumbles. She identified a neighborhood in transition due to the opening of a new metro station. You open a new metro station and suddenly the row houses within walking distance, 6-10 blocks, just leap up in value. And she targeted houses and she really searched hard and she found what looked like a gem of a house. Here was a row house, 18 feet wide rather than the 16 feet as normal, and on the end of the row, which meant that it had windows on the side as well as the front and back, lots of light, lot more space than normal, plus it had a little backyard and space for two cars. So in many ways, this looked like a gem of a house, and it was had been listed at $330,000 and then dropped to $295,000. It was, by the way, a foreclosed owned by a bank. And this was 2 years ago, so the market isn't what it is today. Now, it was almost, the house was almost in shape to live in if you really were willing to rough it. But in truth, everything needed to be gutted and replaced. Everything in the house, I mean, you know, mechanical, electrical, plumbing, all the walls, all the finishes, except possibly the hardwood floors. And this is the norm when the house has been a low-income rental for decades, is that there really isn't much of anything usable except the shell. Best thing about the house, from my point of view as her dad, was also it was right across the street from a police station. And I saw that as a great plus. So she offered the seller $285,000, and they accepted. Then, after they accepted, she talked to me and asked me to come up and look at it, to do a professional inspection. That's not the way you should do it. And you should always get someone who knows what they're doing to look at the property before you make an offer, because it's harder to back out if something's wrong afterwards. Well, the house was in just as bad of shape as I expected, or as she expected. Everything had to be replaced. However, remember that I said that on the typical row house, the outside walls are 8-inch thick brick? That's all. No studs, no insulation, 8-inch thick brick. Well, the side wall next to the alley, instead of being straight up, actually bowed out about 6 inches. A masonry wall, the bow is bowing out. It's not good. And when I looked in the basement, that masonry wall had been pushed out, had moved out about 6 inches from the foundation. I was afraid that if I touched that wall the wrong way, the whole two-story side would collapse. And in fact, there were bricks that were already falling out of it. So this was a bit too much to take on. You know, the one thing about these row houses is typically they are structurally sound. This is one that was very unstructurally sound and, in fact, almost frighteningly so. So she withdrew her contract for cause, and that was, lesson one. Then she found the real house, really right across the street. Really, actually, this one was right across the street from the metro station. Had no basement, but it was the larger three-room version, totally uninhabitable. But she had learned that she asked me to inspect it first before she made an offer. This one was a duplex, and beside it, on the other side, they'd done an awful infill new house. It was a pseudo-Victorian, complete with a tower. Really ugly. That was a negative. And it's a negative you can't fix. Sometimes when you're walking down, you know, sometimes when you're walking down the street in these neighborhoods, you'll see, you know, the old-time residents sitting up on the porches, and they'll call out to you, "Hey, man, don't look at this house. It's ours." So there is some resentment of gentrification. There's some resentment that, you know, people are buying these houses and fixing them up. However, in this case, I was talking to the daughter of the lady who lived on the other half of the duplex, and she was just tickled pink that someday someone would pay $300,000 for her mama's broken down, almost unlivable house. If you happen to be living in one of these houses for all these years and own it, this is an enormous windfall for you. And it's not if you're a tenant and someone else owns it. Okay. Well, I'm being told, well, okay, let me finish this. But the negative for Elizabeth was that Mama in that house next, row house next door, had no plans to move, and therefore there were no plans to fix up the other half of this duplex for years. The other negative for me, I was upstairs looking out the back window of the house and watched a drug deal go down in the alley. So we didn't look at that house. Back from the break, we'll get on to more cheerful house hunting.
Ask the experts. Call toll-free right now, 1-866-472-5787.
Hello?
And ask our all-star team to answer your question. That's 1-866-472-5787.
Thank you for calling.
VoiceAmerica.com.
Frankly Speaking About Cancer is a program designed to empower survivors and their caregivers to deal with the social and emotional challenges of cancer. Drawing on resources from wellness communities throughout America and abroad, the show will invite physicians, researchers, nurses, social workers, patients, and caregivers to share their advice on how to live a better life with cancer. Join host Kim Tibaldo, President and CEO of the Wellness Community, Tuesday afternoons at 1 p.m. Pacific Time and 4 p.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Health and Wellness Network. Tune into Around the World in a Glass, presented by Sportsman's. We're a show all about wine, spirits, and other beverages. Your host, Kimber Stonehouse, is a professional expert and wine enthusiast. Each week, we'll focus on a different region of the world, discuss wines and other beverages, talk about some of the top restaurants in the region, and what to pair with which wine. Just listening could make you almost an expert. Around the World in a Glass is heard live every Wednesday at noon Pacific Time, 3 p.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Variety Channel.
The Internet's number one talk station. Number one talk station. VoiceAmerica.com.
You're tuned into Winning the Dream Home Race with your host, Steve Klipp. We'd love to hear from you about our program. Call in to 1-866-472-5788. Again, that's 1-866-472-5788. Or send an email to clipark@yahoo.com. That's C-L-I-P-P-A-R-C-H at yahoo.com. Now back to winning the dream home race.
Well, to make a long story short, Elizabeth did find a row house on a good street with all gentrifying homes for, and it was for an acceptable, but what still seems like an enormous price. And it had the benefit that it was roughly livable while she renovated it. She took more than a year, did a lot of do-it-yourself labor, a lot, plus a lot more money, and she essentially completely gutted and rebuilt the town, the row house, and knew everything, mechanical, electrical, plumbing, moved everything around, made it into a really nice house for herself. And also, I am sure she's made a substantial profit when she sells. I don't sound proud of her, do I? However, it was really hard to do what Elizabeth did. In addition to being a glutton for punishment, you have to have access to a lot of cash money. Banks are reluctant to write mortgages for project houses, and even less likely to lend you the money to do the construction to renovate them. So for most people, you know, that's not possible. At least it's not possible with the scale of dollars that you're talking about in Washington, D.C. So most people will buy somebody else's project house. Elizabeth and I have gone to a lot of open houses in D.C. and primarily because I'm interested, she's interested, and it's a great Sunday afternoon entertainment. They're almost always within walking distance of her row house. Other row houses, they have open houses, part of which is, in her case, just scoping out the market, seeing what's available, what's being built, and what is selling for. Now, if you are in the market for a row house in D.C., or anywhere, really, there are four possible conditions that the product is in when you buy it. First, as we discussed, a row house with decades of neglect and almost untenable. In essence, when you buy that, you're buying the land and the shell of a house. Hopefully you're buying at bottom dollar. In D.C., that means paying about 60 cents on the dollar. In other words, trying to pay $250 a square foot instead of $400 a square foot for a finished house. The problem is, you know, that the problem with looking for one of these, first of all, they're often in bad neighborhoods, and you really have to judge the neighborhood, and you really have to judge whether it's on the way up, whether it's on the way down, or like the one house I was telling you about, there's an ugly project right beside it on one side, and on the other side is a row house that is going to continue to look like a slum, you know, for the foreseeable future. If you've got the house in between those two, you're going to have a hard time selling and getting your money back. The other problem is that these are the houses that the flippers want. And the flippers, they often have inside information and get to them before you. So you're in competition with them for these houses. And the second, you know, the second possible condition that the house is in, one of these row houses, is that the 100-year-old row house has been cared for, that it's had older occupied, it's been cared for, and updated over the years, but not recently. For instance, the kitchen was replaced 30 years ago and is still usable okay. The bath, often there's only one bath, the bath was replaced 20 years ago. it's usable and okay. The house needs work, but it's livable. There you're hoping to pay, or not hoping, there you actually are going to pay about 75 cents on the dollar, maybe $300 a square foot for this house because it's livable right now. And again, you're competing with the flippers for the house. They are, if you're a do-it-yourselfer with limited funds, this may be your best bet because you can live there. It is actually a house you can live in, and you can fix things up as you have money and time to do it. It's also easier to get a loan. But take a step back. If you're going to gut the house and you're going to put in all new plumbing, electrical, mechanical, as well as update the floor plan, if you're really going to do it over well, then it doesn't make sense to pay a premium for a house that is decent to live in now because you're going to rip all of that out. So if your plan is a complete renovation and a really nice row house and you can swing it, you're better off getting the house that is unlivable than the one that is semi-livable. Okay, find where I am. Now, there is no advantage to buying the semi-livable over the unlivable house, and it will cost more money. The last two categories of house are really a matter of degree. These are the completely redone, sparkling new, ready for resale row houses. The last two categories really are the houses that you see on the open house tours on Sunday afternoons. And they can be divided into two classes. The cheaply done makeovers and the thoroughly remade, quote unquote, new homes. The issue from the point of view of a buyer, you looking at the houses, is that there's very little difference in asking price between these two. And it is hard to tell one from the other. Now, I told you the DC in-town row house market is hot. And these houses are selling right now for about $400 a square foot for your standard 12 to 1500 square foot row house. That's $600,000. On paper, they all look the same. But the market is hot right now. Take a step back and look at it. If you buy a cheaply redone makeover and the market, you're buying a lesser product, if the market cools down, your house would drop in value more sharply. The cheaply, you know, plus, well, the other thing is that the cheaply done makeover, your cost of maintenance will be higher as the hidden problems surface. And let me see if I can explain this again. Told you you make your money on the front end when you buy a house. And it's only confirmed on the back end when you sell it. So if you overpay for the cheaply done makeover, you'll be punished on the back end because someone else will not be as willing to pay full price for that. As opposed to the very well done, totally rejuvenated home that will continue to have value. And that's what you need to look for on the market. Okay. Let's go to break while I figure out what I'm trying to say here. But well, okay, there are exceptions to this, you know, to this general rule that I'm talking about. But in general, a flipper would do a cheap makeover rather than a thorough job. When you think about it, there are good reasons for this. He will never live in the house. So because he will never live there, every surface in the house is the low-end choice. You know, what he can get by with rather than what's a nice touch. If a homeowner does the same house, they tend to splurge on special touches and they tend to spend extra money in places. You as the buyer get the benefit of that without additional cost. This is fine. You know, this is fine and expected if you're selling $150,000 houses or if you're buying a $150,000 house. But these are $600,000 homes. And as I kept reminding my daughter, this is a $600,000 home or a $500,000 home or whatever it is. It should have the finishes that you would expect in a $600,000 home. And, you know, as I say, the flippers typically don't put them in there. When we come back from break, we're going to break now. I'll tell you about the real issue I have with a lot of these homes and why I was really disappointed in what I saw when we went on these open houses.
Talk, talk, talk. That's all we do is talk.
Yeah!
If you'd like to talk, call us toll-free right now at 1-866-472-5787. 1-866-472-5787.
That's it.
That's it.
VoiceAmerica.com.
Ever wondered what private investigators really do and how they go about solving cases? Each week, PIs Declassified gives a glimpse into this little-known world. Join your host, Francie Kaler, a noted private investigator, in conversations with detectives and experts in the field. False confessions, forensic evidence, finding missing persons, exposing fraud, exonerating the innocent. All areas that Francie and her guests will cover. And have they got stories to tell? Tune in and call in to the live show Thursdays at 9 a.m. Pacific, noon Eastern, on Voice America Variety.
Tune into Goddard Design every week for everything that is arts, interior design, and architecture. Host Chris Goddard will help you explore and invite creativity into your life. Our guests will include industry leaders and insiders who take you through the entire world of design and its many facets. You may not be immediately aware, but design is involved in nearly everything we do, from homes to clothing to food and drink. Tune into Goddard Design every Wednesday at 4 p.m. Eastern Time, 1 p.m. Pacific, on the Voice America Variety Channel.
Stimulating talk.
It gets those synapses in the brain firing really fast.
All the time.
The number one internet talk station where your opinion counts. VoiceAmerica.com.
You're tuned into Winning the Dream Home Race with your host, Steve Klipp. We'd love to hear from you about our program. Call in to 1-866-472-5788. Again, that's 1-866-472-5788. Or send an email to clipart@yahoo.com. That's C-L-I-P-P-A-R-C-H at yahoo.com. Now, back to Winning the Dream Home Race.
You can always tell a flipper house, and by the way, there are some exceptions. There are some flippers who do a really good job. But in general, if all of the finishes in the house look trendy and okay, but really a little bit cheap for that price of house, that's a flipper house. But my biggest complaint with the cheap makeover is that none of the rooms change. These row houses were built 100 years ago, and they were designed for how people lived 100 years ago. They have a living room in front, a formal dining room in the middle, and a galley kitchen stuck on the back. Think of the row house as a townhouse. If you were laying out this same townhouse unit today, this is not what you would do. Today's townhouse, and there are a lot of them, I mean, that really have the same format as these row houses. Today's townhouse would have the kitchen on the front and the main living space to the back of the house with French doors out to a garden or a deck. Privacy and indoor-outdoor connection. Or, if it's a deeper unit, today's townhouse would have a swing room on the front that can be used as a dining room or an office, then the kitchen, and then a great room with doors out to the back. That's how you design that house today and for today's living. As long as we're redoing everything in the row house, it should work for today's lifestyle. These houses, row houses, are 100 years old. The plumbing is no good. The electrical is no good. The heating and air conditioning is no good. You have to redo all of these anyway if you're doing a complete job. And what I worry about with the flippers or the cheap makeovers is that the reason they don't move the walls, reinvent things, is because they're not reinventing what is behind the wall. They are stubbing off of the old plumbing. They are using the old electrical. And, you know, when someone is doing a cheap makeover and just doing things that look good on the surface, you never know what the hidden problems are. The hidden problems can come back and bite you if you're the buyer. Well, I was really, you know, I go out on these open houses with my daughter and I look at these units and have been really quite appalled by most of them. It's just interesting. Here's a paid political announcement. Use a good design professional. Use an architect when you renovate one of these homes. The fact that the homes are small, that they're 1,200 to 1,500 square feet, means that the quality of the design has to be even higher. When you've got big spaces, sometimes just a big space works and, you know, and is acceptable. When you've got small spaces, you have to use it wisely. And you really need to hire someone who has a design background. I look at the kitchens. I go into these houses, these row houses. The first thing they do is they tend to leave the kitchen on the back of the house, and which isolates it. You know, I've done shows on what's the way people live today. It is a combined kitchen family room, kitchen great room. They leave the kitchens on the back of the house, which isolates them and cuts them off from the living room. Quite often, you still have this stupid formal dining room in the middle. This isn't how people live today. And they're only doing it because of a lack of imagination and laziness and leaving things the way they are. So you have these kitchens on the back, and I look at these kitchens, and so many of them are just really poorly laid out. Even if you leave it in the back, you've got an 11-foot wide room by typically 11 by 16, 11 by 20. That's too wide for a galley kitchen and too narrow for a kitchen with an island in the middle. So I see them and they stick the cabinets on one wall and they stick them on the other wall with this great big chunk of space in the middle that has no function. If you can figure out some way to do an L shape and even bend the sink around so that the sink is looking out through the back windows to the outside. So many of these kitchens I see, they also make the mistake, the sinks are on the side wall. You don't want to look at a wall when you're doing your dishes. And they don't have an eat-in space. But that is really what I saw most disappointing, is that they don't reinvent the space as they do it. And then you go upstairs, and again, they haven't reinvented the space. Almost always there's one bathroom, and I've seen $600,000 do-overs where they've left one bathroom. You need two bathrooms. Plus you need a powder room on the main floor. And you have to find room for this. You have to put the powder room in such a way on the main floor that it's not under the stairs in the middle of the house. So everyone sitting in the dining room or the living room watches you as you step into the powder room. This is design. And the flippers especially are doing all the surfaces, but they're not doing design. And we get some really crappy spaces. Is that strong enough in feeling? And I look at it, you know, I look at these things. They really can be done better when you treat it like any other house. You treat it like any other house, and good design sells. Good design is better to live in. What is the living room that you would like to sit in? You know, what are the attributes to it? What is the dining area? And somewhat getting lost in this. Yes. I'm actually totally lost looking at these pictures of very poorly done units where a lot of money is poured in and things are awkward. Perhaps the best thing you can do with one of these row houses is figure out how to make them unawkward. And then figure out what is selling today. If you've got the upstairs, the bedrooms, okay, three bedrooms sells better than two. There is a way you can squeeze three bedrooms or two bedrooms into a 16-foot wide house. Do it. Two bathrooms sell more. There's a way to do it. Trying to figure out how close to break we are, the end. But really, when you evaluate these, you're looking at someone else's work. Look at it as an investment and think, what someone else will buy. And that's what you buy. You know, if it seems awkward to you, don't buy it. Anyway, I think I'm going to end this program. Anyway, thank you for listening. And just want to caution people that when you get into very small spaces, like these row houses, the better the design, the higher the value, the better the resale on your house. So don't be fooled by new finishes. Don't be fooled by glitzy, you know, stuff. Look at how it lives. Think about what you want in the house. Think about what works and buy that. Because when you go to sell, that's what someone else will buy. Thanks for listening.
Thanks again for listening to Winning the Dream Home Race. Please join your host, Steve Klipp, again next Thursday at 5 p.m. Pacific Time, 8 p.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Variety Channel. We'll help you come one step closer to building or renovating your dream home.